Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck faces? What's happening? Yeah, I threw a new one in there. Someone just sent it to me. I'm sure I've had it on the list before. What the fuck faces? Who wants to be that? Who? Did I just speak to someone out there? Did someone just think I'm a fuck face? But now I threw one in there. So how's it going? You all right? I'm Mark Maron. This is my show, WTF. It's a podcast. You've got it plugged into your head. How's it going in there? Got a good show today. Gus Van Sant is here. He's on the show. He's not here right now as I speak to you, but he's on the show. How good is watermelon? That's just a non sequitur, but in the summertime, man, I've been eating so much fucking watermelon. I think it's good. I hope it's not making me pre-diabetic, but it's part of this dumb diet I'm on, kind of. You know when they say you can eat things that have any amount of sugar in a totally non-sugar situation? You eat a lot. I'm going through a couple melons a week. It's a bad habit. I got a watermelon habit. I got a melon on my back. Oh, man. I can't wait for summer to be over so I can stop just carrying around watermelons. It's bad, man, when you get itchy and you get kind of squirrely and you got to run out to Whole Foods or Vons or Ralph's or wherever the fuck you can get a melon. Oh, jeez. But it's good. Put a little salt on it. Awesome. That's it. That's my summertime tip. Salt your melon. All right? That's, how's that? Is that all right? Before I forget, let me tell you what's happening. I'm going to be at the Ice House this week, the 19th, 20th, and 21st, doing shows, working on that hour. I'm going to be at Wise Guys in Salt Lake City on the 3rd and 4th. Of August. I'll be in Chicago. I think that show sold out at the Thalia Theater, I believe is where I'm playing. August 30th through September 1st, I'll be in Bloomington at the Comedy Attic. And September 6th through 8th, I'll be in Minneapolis at Acme. And September 21 and 22, I'll be at Denver at the Comedy Works doing some club work. I'll provide links for that on my site. That's what's happening. I don't think I've talked to you guys since GLOW got nominated for all these Emmy Awards. They got nominated for a bunch of Emmy Awards. No, I did not get one. And no, I did not get robbed. And no, I did not. It's like the sort of imposed competition thing is a little disturbing in some ways. You know, I'm glad that a lot of you thought that I should have got one. But the fact is, it's all gravy for me, folks. Everything is going fine. I'm not a big award-winning guy for whatever reason. You know, there were times towards the beginning, the first couple of years of this podcast, where I really was upset that we didn't get a Peabody, and I think it was because the word fuck is in the title of the show, or there was some fuck at the Peabody's who didn't want to, you know, give us the fucking satisfaction of getting one of those things. And what does it really mean in the long run? The fact of the matter is that people enjoy what we're putting out there. They enjoy what I'm putting out there. I'm making an honest living out of it, and I'm thrilled. The show got nominated for a Best Comedy Series, Production Design for Narrative Program. That was also nominated. Casting for a Comedy Series, Jen Houston and her crew. That's great. Cinematography for a Single Camera Series nomination, great. Directing for a Comedy Series, great. Hairstyling for a Single Camera Series, nice. Congratulations, ladies. Outstanding Main Title Sequence, that is amazing. It's all amazing. Makeup for a Single Camera Series, awesome. Stunt Coordination for a Comedy Series, a Variety Program, awesome. And then Betty Gilpin. Fucking Betty Gilpin. Gets nominated for Best Supporting. That is spectacular. Betty is such a force, man. I didn't know Betty at all before we started doing it, but she is a complete sort of questing oddball. She's a real risk taker with what she does. No matter what she does in terms of how she's approaching a character, she's going to push it, and it's something to watch. I love working with all these people. I love working with those women. And again, this imposed competition thing is annoying. Look, I know we're all competitive. I think that by nature, people are competitive. Maybe you kind of have to be to survive. Well, let's assume that your genetics have gotten you here. So there was some natural competition along the way in the last couple of thousand years. And remind me to tell you about genetics, because I got my genetic breakdown back. And boy, what a surprise. Oh, yeah, you guys are going to be really surprised. I waited weeks for this. And, you know, I was supposed to do that show where they do the sort of like, this is your life genetic show, and they never got back to me. And now I know why. Now I know why. My genes have persisted, but they stop with me. In my particular line, they stop with me. I have no children. My brother has kids, but they stopped with him too because his kids are all adopted. But that, you know, nothing, that's great. You know, kids are kids. But you know, I don't know if it was part of our innate desire to not propel the sort of legacy of what we come from. Obviously, it's not malignant. It's not horrible. It's a little needy, a bit erratic, somewhat self-involved, and maybe at times depressive and anxious. But look. I got my 23andMe back, and I was excited about it. I went all in, you know, like, give me the whole breakdown. Tell me what I'm going to get. Tell me, you know, what I'm destined to die of, the whole business. And drum roll, please, because my ancestry reports, my ancestry composition is Jew. I don't know if that's unique to me, but it just says Jew. Basically, it says 99.5% Ashkenazi Jewish. So I guess no surprises, no Viking. I was hoping for a little bit of Viking. I was hoping for a little bit of something. There's a 0.4% of broadly European, but it all looks right around that Russian, Poland, that whole, the green spot on the big global map is in the area that I kind of knew, but I was really hoping that somewhere back there, my great, 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 great grandmother may have consensually fucked a Viking, so I get a little of that. But that's not there. But now I know. Now I know. I'm a full-on Jew with about 4% of Broadway European that is also probably Jewish. So there you go. Now we all know. Hey, a couple of things. Just in the climate we live in, anytime you're thinking they can't, they can. Anytime you're thinking they wouldn't, they would. Every time you think they won't, they will. And there doesn't seem to be anything holding them back. So I'm going at this early. I'll bring it up occasionally. To your friends who are detached from the process, who feel that they don't have a place in the political world or that may not have an effect on their lives, please start planting the seeds for them to vote in November and to spread the word. They can, they will, they do. Everything you imagine. It's so profoundly amazing how quickly and easily people in this country and people in power shamelessly slip into complete moral depravity and moral bankruptness. It's a human thing. It's nothing unique. Everybody's got that slippery slope. It's just all you need is an opportunity, and you could find yourself in some deep shit. Well, a lot of people have found that opportunity and power, and we're all in some deep shit because of complete, shameless, personal, and moral corruption. It's really quite astounding. They will, they can, they do. Dig it. Oh, also, another thing. I get emails occasionally. You know, when I have a big actor in here, specifically recently, maybe Josh Brolin and Paul Rudd, and I seem slightly condescending to superhero movies, and you think that's rude, I want to tell you this, you know, honestly and from my heart. I will continue doing it. I will continue to condescend to grown-ups who defend almost, you know, maniacally the integrity and need and greatness of superhero movies. Look, I'm all for entertainment. I'm glad you enjoy it. I don't go. I'm not even saying that I wouldn't enjoy it. What I'm saying is the consolidation and leveling of the culture's taste to infantile intent and product is something that's been coming for a long time. It's great for movie companies. They can just, you know, guaranteed to make millions on franchises that were fundamentally designed for children. So the fact that you're a grown-ass fucking person and you've, you know, kind of justified it in your periphery and your fucking worldview that these are great and you just can't get enough of them, great, that's good for you. But the truth of the matter is it pushes away and it pushes aside, you know, real dialogue and real human stories that now you got to go to Siberia. I got to go to the Lamley to see a movie that, you know, is grown-up themed and is actually provocative and proactive in terms of making you think and making you move forward with your life and seeing things differently. Now I have to go. I got to go find those. I got to watch those in my living room because the audience isn't big enough to justify the release of these films that, you know, were once known as grown-up movies, thrillers, like Michael Clayton's a good example. But you can keep coming at me about my tone around Marvel movies or any of the superhero movies. I'm going to remain condescending as a grown person who questions them. And usually when I'm talking to an actor, it's slightly condescending, but it's really ribbing. I'm just busting balls. And every time I've done it, they knew exactly what I was doing and they have it within them too. But money is money. Entertainment is entertainment. But it was not supposed to be that every movie has to be like a fucking amusement park ride. It wasn't supposed to be that, you know, oh, why are they talking? What am I listening to? How come someone's not flying? Where's the blowing up? Wait, and, you know, maybe I sound like an old man, but you're a grown person. You know, just lighten up. I can have my point of view and I'll remain condescending because I feel like that's the place to be on this one. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings and you're mad that I don't like the flying man. I'm sorry. You want some ice cream? You want some ice cream or do you want a beer? You're old enough to have beer. You're old enough to have had too much beer. Don't cry because I made fun of the caped guy. I saw that Tripwitz movie, that documentary. That was kind of mind-bending, very provocative, really kind of amazing, actually. Been seeing a lot of movies. I saw David Diggs's movie, Blindspotting. I'm going to talk to him on Thursday. And that was a great sort of real personal heartfelt Oakland movie that had some interesting sort of emotional and cultural twists in it from a very kind of grounded and human place. It was great to see. I'll talk to him about that on Thursday. I talked today to Gus Van Sant about his movie, Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot, which again is a very human story. It deals with recovery. It deals with grief. It deals with tragedy. There's some beautiful stuff in this movie. And Joaquin Phoenix is pretty fucking amazing, man. You know, it's weird that, you know, as I talk to actors and I work with actors, you can see how they, you know, where they come from with their acting. You know, it's a very interesting part of my life to kind of see how stories are told and how people construct characters and do things. It's I don't know. I'm enjoying it as the world burns, if you don't mind. So obviously, Gus Van Sant has done a lot of films. Good Will Hunting, Elephant, To Die For, Drugstore Cowboy, he remade Psycho. I mean, there's a lot of films this man has done, a lot of different types of movies, and a lot of which I've seen and enjoyed and found to be very provocative. Some of his smaller movies, Elephant and what was that one, Last Days, I think it was called, very poetic and very challenging and great. And it was sort of like I was a little nervous to talk to him, but I like talking to directors, especially ones that kind of do a lot of different things, that take chances, that take risks. There's nothing better than talking to creative people who are willing to take risks, willing to fail, you know, willing to keep pushing to find a truth that in a way that hasn't been explored yet. So this was an honor for me, and this is me and Gus Van Sant, and the movie I mentioned. Don't worry, he won't get far on foot, is now playing. So this is me and
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Gus. How long you played for?
Long time, like 30 years.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, that's what I did too. Like, you just play by yourself.
Yeah.
You play along with records and stuff?
Yeah, I'd play along with all kinds of records.
Yeah, like what?
In my history. I used to play with Charlie Christian.
Oh, so you can really do it?
Yeah, I can do that.
Really?
And it's mimicking, you know, because I don't know what I'm doing. I can't say, oh, that's an A, that's right. A C, that's an E. And even now, I'm like, I should have learned this kind of thing, you know, like.
Well, you can't though. I don't read music, but you can identify chords.
Yeah, I can do chords, like the major chords.
Sure.
I can't go into like minor sevenths everywhere on the fretboard, but I can learn them, you know.
But you can sort of noodle around with Charlie Christian.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty good. Like, you do T-Bone Walker too.
I can probably do anybody, or like play along with the record where they're playing.
Right.
I can kind of like, so the people that I've emulated are like Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton.
Right. Yeah. I mean, definitely. Yeah.
They're easy. I mean, Hendrix is easy if you got a Strat.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if you just get into a thing, you can
kind of sound like him.
Sort of.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't even know the right chords. If you learn the Hendrix chords, then you can really sound like him.
No. Yeah. I mean, I used to do that all the time. I had a Strat out in my old place, and it's the tone. It sounds like him. So you're like a real player then. You've been like, I didn't play with people for years. It's sort of a meditative thing. Feels good, right?
I'm just sort of daydreaming and
on the couch.
Everywhere. I've always got it there.
So, how long have you lived in Los Feliz?
I think officially for a year. Like, I sold my last place in Oregon, and I live here and Palm Springs.
Oh, okay. So you did. Well, that's nice.
So I'm not stuck here.
You can go to a hotter place when it gets hot here in LA. Yeah.
Although even 120 in Palm Springs isn't like the weather we're having here. 94 here is hotter.
What do you make of that? Why is that, you think? Because of the
humidity,
air?
I think.
Humidity?
So there's just no humidity over there, so you can kind of like...
Dry.
Yeah.
And you walk outside and it feels good until you realize you have no liquid in your body.
Exactly.
But it sneaks up on you.
You have to drink, yeah, for sure.
So do you miss... I mean, it's a big shift, but Portland's very specific. Do you miss that?
Well, I'd been there for so long that I think at this point I don't miss it. I probably would miss it or will miss it like in a few years.
Yeah.
I'll just go like, I should really just get back there.
How long did you live there? Did you grow up? You grow up there though, right?
I moved there when I was 17 in 1970.
Yeah.
Or 16. And went to 2 years of high school. And then I went to college in Rhode Island and then moved back to...
At RISD?
RISD, yeah.
You did?
Yeah.
What years? Where's that? Like in the
71 to 75.
Who was there? Who do we know?
The famous Talking Heads were there.
The Heads were there? Yeah.
Charlie Rocket was there. Do you remember him?
He killed himself, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He was there. He was one of my big influences, actually.
Really?
As a person.
I said that so glibly. He killed himself, right? Like, that's a point of reference. It's sad, but...
I know.
How was he an influence?
He and one of the film students, I was in the film department, they would go out and do this thing that Charlie was already doing called Meet the Stars. Charlie would go out on his own, dressed up, to just meet Alice Cooper, see if he could get backstage. It was really like, can we get backstage without any credentials?
Were they shooting it?
And then with Scott Sorensen, he started shooting it. This is like for class projects,
right,
kind of thing, and which they did later on Saturday Night Live a little bit. And it just was, I saw it in a class and thought it was super funny and joined them a couple times and screwed up the sound.
Are you the sound guy?
I was the sound guy.
Yeah.
And he was just also a singer, lead singer of the Motels.
Charlie Rocket was?
Yeah, not the L.A. version, the punk rock band, but the Providence, Rhode Island Motels.
Oh, I didn't know that. There were two.
Fabulous Motels.
There were two. Yeah. Oh, now I know that. That's great.
And the Fabulous Motels in Providence, I think, is kind of forgotten, lesser known, but it was in Providence, it was like the biggest thing we had.
What kind of music was it?
It was art rock,
sure.
It was a band that would come out playing as one band called like Iron Grandmother or something like that.
Right.
Funny. It was comedy rock, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And like the Tubes.
Yeah, sure.
And would play as Iron Grandmother for like six or seven songs. Then they would go backstage and, and change into the motels or electric driveway or some other.
So they all went to RISD?
And they all were RISD students.
Oh, yeah.
And they started really from Martin Mull.
Oh, like, really?
Martin Mull had a band called Soup, and that evolved into...
He was at RISD as well?
He was at RISD. He was a painter, yes.
So he's a painter again, I believe.
And he's a painter again. Yeah. So comedy rock.
Right.
Or in his case, jazz. Comedy jazz. And I saw him play at the Roxy. But he sort of, in the mid-60s, had a band, and then Tim Duffy took over, and there was a band called Snake and the Snatch.
Uh-huh.
And that sort of engendered like a few other bands, and eventually the Motels.
Wow. Good, a real legacy.
Yeah.
That's wild,
I've studied it.
You have?
Yeah. I tried to.
And the
Talking Heads were like David Byrne would do some things along with the band, I think performance pieces in between sets and things. So he was sort of in there sometimes.
Yeah. So you were there in the 70s?
Early 70s to mid 70s.
So like at that time, post 60s, I mean, that's when all that performance art, everything was really blowing up at that time.
Yeah. It was the 60s were kind of hanging over into the 70s.
Yeah.
And so everyone that was the older students like Charlie Clavery or Charlie Rocket, or even Martin Mull, they were kind of the senior frontiersmen that had invented certain things and continued on. And we were newbies and sort of learning from them, like, oh, you don't have to do architecture. You can do rock music or pottery.
Or whatever you want.
Something different than what you already do.
And what did you start out doing?
I was, I think everyone, a lot of people were painters.
Yeah.
I know the Talking Heads were all painters. And I was a painter, but I majored in film.
You did.
Filmmaking.
Do you still paint?
And I still paint, yes.
You do?
Yeah.
You've got, and do you show your paintings and everything?
Sometimes, when I'm lucky, I show my paintings.
Figurative, abstract, what do you?
A little bit figurative and a little bit abstract.
Uh-huh. But you like doing it, not unlike guitar. It's something that you enjoy doing, but don't feel pressured.
Exactly.
To do.
Exactly.
It's yours.
Exactly.
Well, you do that with film too, but like with those things, it's like you don't have to tell anybody, you don't have to do it for anybody.
Right.
It's nice.
Exactly. Yeah, it's nice.
So out of RISD, because it seems to me that the 70s, like after the 60s, like once the hippie got drained out of the 70s and it just became, you know, drugs and sex and it had a little more edge to it, that seemed to be sort of the petri dish of where you started to develop your sensibility.
Yeah, I think... I mean, it was influenced, I think, by all the things that happened in the 60s were kind of culminating in 71 is when I ended up there, in making art, in this case, because we were in art school.
But how much of it was a reaction to Vietnam?
As much as you were involved in Vietnam already,
yeah.
I think everyone was, but it was partly that or a reaction to the reactions to Vietnam, or some people had been in Vietnam, and one of my classmates had a nervous breakdown in a submarine in
Vietnam, really?
In the Pacific, yeah, who was a painter. So there were people with you that had been in combat.
And, wow.
But, I mean, just the whole... thing that was happening in the 60s, whatever you could call it, was still happening in the 70s, and by mid 70s I think it was sort of changing.
So you finish RISD, you go all four?
I went all 4 years. I tried to leave after my first year, and then I was talked back into it by my parents, of course. And
oh yeah, they were supportive though. That's a good sign.
They were supportive, and then I graduated in 75 and came via Europe. I went to Europe for a little while and then came to LA.
What'd you do? What were you doing in Europe? Just hanging around?
I went on a student group, a film group, and we were visiting in Rome. We were visiting filmmakers.
Who'd you talk to?
So we talked to Fellini. We talked to, yes.
How many people were with you?
There were about eight.
Wow.
Eight, and then there were about 16 in total, but that particular visit was about eight students.
Huh.
We went to the set of Casanova. We went to the set of Seven Beauties by Lena Wertmüller.
Oh, my God.
We went to talk to Pasolini.
Really?
In his house, but it was just a couple months before he died. Tinto Brass was a filmmaker. He was making Salon Kitty, which was sort of a semi-porno entertainment.
Yeah. Did it have an impact on you?
I think it was just amazing. I mean, we were amazed.
Was it the first time you were on sets?
Yes. Exactly.
So you're on Fellini's set.
Fellini's set.
Did anything impact you about how he worked or anything? I mean,
it was night and it was late at night. I think we ended up getting there about 11 because they were shooting all night.
Uh-huh.
And they shot until, say, 2 o'clock. And when we got there, there was a cauldron. It was at a farmhouse.
Yeah.
So the fire was lighting up the set, and there was some extra light sort of like flashing. And in the middle of, there was a group of 25 people in folding director's chairs.
Yeah.
In a square.
Like yeah.
5x5. In the middle of them was the tallest woman in the world who was in the film.
Right.
In costume. She was in an extra large chair. So it was kind of this weird graphic of 25 people. And we were told, like, in whispers, that Fellini and Donald Sutherland weren't getting along and that, like, they're discussing the scene and they've been discussing it for an hour and we're all just sitting here waiting. And I said, well, who are all these people in the chairs? And they're like, well, they're people that insist that without them, Fellini cannot make a movie, each one of them. So his entourage, I guess.
Really?
That's what I was told. Yeah. As I was, I was 21. I was
right.
Going, okay, gotcha. I thought in my head I was thinking bullshit.
Or it's better than thinking like, make note, need 25 people to travel with me at all times and sit in a square.
Or as I realize in Italy, when you go to a film festival, there will be a lot of people around. Like they'll invite the cardinal and the bishop, and they'll invite people from the military. They invite people that they kind of need to invite.
Yeah.
And so they end up not necessarily needing to be there, but they're there.
Right.
So there might have been the same with Fellini's group.
Did you eventually get to see him direct? Or you left?
No, I think they discussed the whole time. The tallest woman in the world got up to go to the bathroom, which was funny because when she rose up, everyone kind of cowered because she was so tall.
Yeah.
And she went to the bathroom, came back. I don't think I remembered seeing any sort of
work.
Filming.
Yeah.
Work.
Did he talk to you guys?
And then on the way back from the set, when we broke, he talked to us as we walked.
Yeah.
And I wasn't one of the lead, like there were two of my fellow students were on either side.
Right.
So I was listening to them talk rather than talking directly.
Uh-huh. And did Wertmuller make an impact?
We had lunch with them. I mean, we knew her. I knew her work.
Is she still around?
I think she is.
She was a bit of a character, I remember. You know, I remember when Seven... I was young when Seven Beauties came out, but I remember it being... she had a very powerful presence.
Yeah, you know? And her white glasses.
Yeah, and the white glasses, yeah.
So she was having... We were having lunch, and Giancarlo Giannini was there at lunch with us, and we just were kind of like part of the lunch. I don't remember speaking directly to her either. But it was interesting.
And Pasolini was old.
Pasolini was, it was more like 8 students talking to him and like, hearing him talk. And so we each were talking directly to him one by one.
Yeah.
He wanted to ask us like what we wanted to do in cinema.
Yeah.
So each of us like had our moment.
How'd you use yours?
And my moment was kind of awkward because I wanted cinema to be a little more malleable, like the novel.
Uh-huh.
And like a given novel. Because in a novel, you can start off one place and, space into like another time period and come back to where you were very easily. Whereas in cinema, you can do that, but it's like difficult for the audience. They seem to need more linear storytelling.
Yeah, yeah.
So I said I wanted to translate literature into film, which is how I put it, and he didn't understand that. He was like,
it's a whole different
why
thing.
Would you do that? Why would you bother?
You
and so I just like let it slide.
That was
like,
it. That was
that was it. There was a translator, so it was like, so, I was like, it's okay.
Okay, yeah, okay. Yeah.
I was nervous. But 2 months later he was gone.
Oh wow.
So we one of the last people.
Well, that sounds exciting. That's an exciting thing to do after college.
And then I went to London to to visit some friends that were there, tried to find work, which wasn't really happening. And I decided, by then I had been in Europe for 3 months, was starting to feel homesick, and decided, I was listening to Joni Mitchell's Blue, and she was singing about California over and over again. And I thought, I should just go, just hang it up, go to California, go to LA.
What were you looking for work? Just on a set? Anything?
Yeah, anything.
Yeah.
You know, and it, there just wasn't a lot of work in general.
Right.
In
there.
In 1975 in London.
Yeah. So you go to LA.
So I just ended up here. And
the first foray into LA?
Yeah. And living on Argyle Street in Franklin.
Oh. Back then, what was that like?
That was nice.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like it is now. It's the same, actually. And there was an apartment that some friends of mine had that I lived with them. And they were bouncers at the Roxy.
Oh, yeah. In the mid-70s?
In the mid-70s. So they would let me in the back door and I could go see the shows.
What was going on then?
I remember seeing John Prine.
Oh, yeah.
I saw...
he's great. I just saw him recently. Still at it.
Yeah.
He just had a new record out.
He was back out, yeah. I saw Patti Smith.
In her heyday.
In her first L.A. performance.
That's great.
I would see people also I didn't know who they were. I would end up in the backstage.
But was it crazy on Sunset Boulevard? I mean, it was
pretty crazy, yeah. And the Rainbow next door and the parking lot in between. There was a lot of dressed up people and craziness. I saw Martin Mull there.
Oh, yeah? Were you guys friends at that point?
And I didn't know him, but I said hi to him in the parking lot.
Uh-huh.
And that I was a RISD student. And
how'd he respond?
He was like, great, fine. But I was a kid. I felt like a fan.
Did you get a job?
I got a job within about 6 months. I got this really great job. As you're looking for work in Hollywood as a young filmmaker, you're given pointers as you're doing it by the people that you're meeting. And somebody said, you can call people up. You can call John Cassavetes up.
Yeah.
You can get him on the phone. They have offices. You can call Alfred Hitchcock up on the phone. And I was like, okay. And I just sort of filed that away. Like, I can do this. So Chevy Chase had come for his first visit to L.A. since he had become a star and Saturday Night Live, which was brand new at that moment. And they asked him in calendar section of the LA Times, what are you going to do when you're in LA? And he said, I'm going to maybe visit a friend, Ken Shapiro, who's a video freak who lives in Beverly Hills. And I was like, oh yeah, Ken Shapiro. He made the Groove Tube.
Sure, man.
And I looked in the phone book and he was there. It was Ken Shapiro. And I thought, I can call him up.
That's There's the one you chose?
And that's the one I chose. And I got a job with him.
did he do Kentucky Fried Movie or just a Groove Tube?
He did
Tube?
The Groove Tube.
Right.
And then he did Modern Problems
later. With Chevy.
With Chevy.
Yeah.
And he had a difficult time because he, the Groove Tube was like a homemade New York movie.
Right. Belzer's in it.
You know, Belzer. Chevy Chase is in it.
I remember, is that the one where Chevy does the bit where he's singing, I'm looking over, and then all of a sudden a guy playing on his head. Right. Yeah. I remember. Yeah.
And there's Brown 25, which is the advertisement for Brown 25, which looks like shit coming from the spigot. There's a lot of great bits. I mean, it's essentially if you look at it, it's Saturday Night Live before Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And Lorne Michaels worked for Ken. Like when I got there, Lorne had just left to do Saturday Night Live a couple months earlier, but he was in the office that we were in working as his writer. And I thought, oh, so he just took Saturday Night Live and pitched it to NBC. Or it was influenced by, it had the news, it had musical acts, it had bits, it had skits, it's coming from TV shows.
Yep.
It had all of it. Not to take away from Lorne Michaels, but...
So you were comedy focused a little.
Yeah, I mean, I liked that film. I liked, I liked Mel Brooks and I liked comedic filmmakers. And working with Ken, I met a lot of the comedians of the period, like Tim Thomerson.
Sure.
Pat Proft was a writer.
Yeah.
And he had come from the Smothers Brothers.
Uh-huh.
And he was Minneapolis, I think. So a lot of the Minneapolis guys were part of the writing. He had these big writing groups who were writing Groove Tube Number 2.
Oh, yeah.
and which never happened. And he had an office at Paramount.
Uh-huh.
So it was like...
You're on the lot.
I was like on the lot.
Yeah.
So for me, that was big stuff.
And what'd you learn from that experience that sent you?
I learned that I wasn't really able to pitch or think up comic situations because I tried a couple times with the professionals and I realized, oh, I'm completely dying.
So you realized like comedy's not for me?
Well, not that kind of comedy.
Right.
I guess I appreciated it.
Yeah.
And I was, I was transfixed by it. And
sure.
I would go to open mic night, which was free at the comedy store.
Like on Mondays?
On Mondays, because it was a free place to go.
Yeah.
And
that's crazy.
Loved it, but that I could probably never do stand-up comedy.
It's interesting that you liked it so much, though.
But I liked it. So I ended up basically rolling joints at the meetings.
Oh, yeah. That was your job.
That was my main job.
God,
and buying the cheese and crackers beforehand.
Yeah. The joint kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's nice. So, but how do you move towards making your first film out of the Shapiro?
That time I sort of had plans. I was, I had this short story written by William Burroughs called The Discipline of DE, which, I had read when I was in Providence in a bookstore. And I, had, by the time I was working with Shapiro or right about that same time, I had also looked up William Burroughs in the phone book in New York City.
At the bunker?
At the bunker. He was in the phone book, and I called him up, and I went over there basically to ask him in person for the rights, and also because in the Jack Kerouac books, that everyone always visited Burroughs.
Yeah, so old Bull Lee.
Exactly.
Yeah, go by.
So I was going to go visit Bull Lee. And our meeting was very cordial. He was very nice. And he had been to L.A., so he gave me addresses of people to look up in L.A.
Uh-huh.
where I was headed. And then I asked at the end of the meeting, would you give me the rights? And he was like, well, you have to call my agent,
uh-huh.
which I did. And then they knew there was no money in short films, so they allowed me to do it. So eventually I made that short, which is about a 7-minute short, and it's on YouTube.
Oh, yeah?
You can see it. And it's comedic. It's funny. And Ken Shapiro did the voiceover for it.
Yeah.
And it's Burroughs' writing. So it's kind of austere, very dry.
He's hilarious, humor. Though.
Yeah.
So he's funny. Hilarious. He's really funny. So you had you were into him since college.
In college from Naked Lunch. And all the, kids were reading Naked Lunch.
Yeah, it's a mind blower. But, when you start to realize the way he, and I imagine you had a relationship with him, because you used him in, what, two movies or one?
Two.
That, he had bits. I mean, he was almost, vaudevillian in his commitment to shtick.
Exactly.
Like, he had characters. He had a way of delivering it. He was a real comic performer.
Yeah, amazing.
The first time I saw him was when he was on Saturday Night Live. In like, what was it, 81 or something. And I had no idea who he was because I was just a freshman in college. And I watched him read those sections from Naked Lunch. And I'm like, what the fuck is this?
Exactly.
Who is that guy?
Yeah.
Mind blower.
I think that's how besides meeting him, I did go to see one of those readings at NYU. He would read there.
Yeah.
And was kind of explained, he read it like a police report. Like his book, and I was like, wow, like a police report, like he's a police captain and at the bench, and he did. That's how he kind of delivered it.
Yeah, he's definitely had a character that was what he was public with. Were you guys friends? Did you remain friends?
I was friends later. I mean, that particular project happened. I showed him a tape.
Yeah,
it was like at that time there wasn't even VHS tape.
Right,
it was like a reel to reel tape, and then it wasn't until later when I was. Making Drugstore Cowboy that there was this character named Old Tom who was an old junkie that our lead character Bob Hughes knew when he was younger and sort of looked up to him.
The minister. Yeah.
Well, now Burroughs turned him into Tom the Priest.
Oh.
But at the time he was just Old Tom, so I thought Burroughs would be the perfect guy to play this character.
Yeah.
And so we sent him the script and he was like, I'd play it, but only if like he had something more going. This guy is like Old Tom, a forgotten older person. I want to be an older person that has something happening. So
yeah.
we said, just whatever you want to do, go ahead, you can do it. Just yeah. so that you do it. And he's so he rewrote his whole part and
made him a priest.
And Matt's part too. He really made all those scenes with them together. Burroughs wrote, or his assistant.
Oh, really?
James wrote.
James Gronholz.
James Gronholz.
Yeah.
And, you know, after that, and we shot it in one day too, which was
They
strange.
Seemed very, like it seemed like the, you know, the walk and talks were improvised.
And those were just them talking, right. making stuff up.
Because
yeah.
like he's very good walk and talk narrator of what's happening.
Yes.
Yeah, I've seen him in documentaries do that. But I could tell that Matt, you know, in character was it was really happening. Whatever was happening was really happening.
And he was going, what do I do? yeah. And Burroughs is like, I used to know an old croaker right there.
Yeah, yeah. But you made one film before that, right?
Yeah, before that I made Malinoche,
yeah.
which was a small book by a poet named Walt Curtis who lived in Portland, which was my first feature film. I had made another, sort of a feature in Hollywood when I was living in Hollywood that didn't really turn out that well.
What was it about?
It was called Alice in Hollywood, about a girl who moves to Hollywood and sort of gets in trouble. It dramatically wasn't really like playing well, so I cut it down. It was a short film by the time I was done with it. And then Malinoche was the film after that.
I didn't see that one. I want to. It's a black and white film, and it's about a, it seemed like a complicated relationship movie.
It's about a gay poet in Skid Row, in Old Town of Portland, and he falls in love with a Mexican migrant boy.
Yeah.
Who's sort of there over the winter. He's trying to survive the winter until the next growing season with his friends.
Yeah.
And they're kind of getting in trouble.
Right.
So the poet like becomes their friend and gives them rides in his car and tries to sort of seduce them, but it doesn't really work out.
The sad longing begins.
Exactly. it's on Filmstruck. You can see that.
Oh, really?
In the Criterion Collection.
Criterion. Oh, good, yeah. Good.
So it exists.
So then, like, that sort of set a theme for you? I mean, like, you know, the tone? Like,
yeah,
you did
because it was like a street story.
Yeah.
It was a poet's story. He's sort of like a Ginsberg of... Walt Curtis is like sort of the Ginsberg of Portland.
Oh, yeah.
Which Ginsberg would hate when Ginsberg would come to Portland. Walt would try to insinuate himself into the scene, and Ginsberg was like, get rid of him. Because he was sort of copying his deal.
Did you know Alan?
Yeah, and I got to be friends with Alan through Burroughs, and through also, we shared a publisher. We had photo books that we had met during this like book signing.
I was just looking at his stuff yesterday because I was going through my books and like all those old City Lights, the Small Pocket series. No, it's really kind of amazing to just even at a glance, any Allen Ginsberg poem is so uniquely his, and so like there's so much movement in them. You know, it's really invigorating just to read a page. He was a nice guy.
Yeah, he was great. I mean, Burroughs was the type of person that really, you know, there were certain things that he really liked to talk about. He liked to talk about guns, knives, poisons,
and
snakes.
Control.
Talk about drugs or especially, government control, conspiracy theories, aliens.
Sure.
Whereas Ginsberg was a little more like, he wanted to hear what you were thinking about. He wanted to teach you about things that had been going on, you know, in the underground, or, you know, like, I guess say like he would explain to you how, during a protest, the feds would put like, troublemakers in the front of the protest cause the
provocateurs,
riot.
Yeah, provocateurs. Agent provocateurs. Yeah.
He would just try and download information that you weren't going to get except from him.
Oh yeah.
Which was, I always thought was really interesting.
So because you're younger than them, and you were sort of like listening to these old guys. Did you ever get to the moment where you're like, all right, I think I've had enough?
Never with either of them.
Oh, that's good.
No, I wanted to always listen to them. I mean, I wasn't really with them like for weeks on end. It was usually like one or two nights or something like that, so I was always like all ears, and they were With Burroughs, my relationship was, I learned at the very end of our relationship before he died that I looked like somebody he knew when he was younger.
Oh, really?
That there was this whole other thing going on that I wasn't really aware of.
No, who told you that?
He did.
Oh, he did?
And I was like, oh, that would, if I, it makes sense, you know, like that he would entertain you like longer. Because you were like actually this person.
Drugstore Cowboy was the first big one, right? Like where everybody's like, what the fuck is this guy's great. I remember seeing it. It was great.
Yeah, after Malinoche, I was able to, with the small exposure I got at film festivals, and the also the independent film scene was happening right about then, mid-80s. It was really, it had been going for a while, but it was there was a system in place. So I kind of like hit it right at the right time, and Avenue Pictures financed Drugstore Cowboy.
Yeah.
Which was a novel that a friend of mine had the manuscript for.
Whose novel was it?
James Fogel, who was a Northwest sort of criminal.
Uh-huh.
And he was in jail at the time that I was shopping it around. He was in Walla Walla State Penitentiary. In Washington. And
it was an unpublished novel?
It was an unpublished novel. He had a few of them.
Yeah.
There was one called Satan Sandbox, and there was one called Drugstore Cowboy, and there was a few others. And
how'd you find that guy?
I found him because of a friend of mine was taking a course with a writer who was teaching in prisons, and he also was teaching outside of prisons as well, and he was hooking up the prisoners, the insiders with the outsiders to basically get manuscripts sent around.
Oh, wow.
And my friend Dan Yost had two of these manuscripts.
Right.
And I was starting to pitch it before I even wrote a script, and eventually Avenue became interested in that one.
So the first film he did was in black and white, and Drugstore Cowboy almost seemed like the color was like saturated or a little high contrast or something. What was the choice on that?
Well, it was weird. I mean, it was shot by Bob Yeoman, who shoots a lot of Wes Anderson movies.
Uh-huh.
I think that what happened color-wise was our art director, David Brisbane, who was an LA guy, had chosen to use a lot of black and a lot of green.
Uh-huh.
Because we really wanted to make a black and white film, but we weren't really allowed to by our producers. So he had chosen to sort of like make it so that your mind saw it in black and white, and even though it was in color.
It also serviced Portland, though, too. Like, there's definitely a darkness.
There's a greenness.
Yeah,
and a blackness. Yeah, that's true.
And then, like, with My Own Private Idaho, like, I still remember, I remember the weirdest part of that movie. I guess it was one of the Johns who, you know, that he's got an apartment where he just sits on a couch and starts rubbing his feet. Mm-hmm. On that, like something that almost looks like this.
Yeah.
What
was that?
Who was that guy?
The guy was our publicist, Mickey Cottrell. And I had invited him to play this part because he would be the type of character. He was the correct type of character.
Yeah.
And he had a lot more, you know, he had written something on his own that was like 25 pages that he expected us to film.
Oh, right.
But when we ended up in the room where he was supposedly living, David Brisbane, again, the production designer from Drugstore Cowboy, also did My Own Private Idaho, put in a new white rug that he said, wear these slippers. Uh-huh. I think that was probably ad-libbed because we had to wear slippers when we went in there because of the pristineness of the white rug. So he had, in that case, when we were rehearsing, his shoes slipped on the carpet because it was so new.
Yeah.
And he had these new, like, sort of dress shoes.
Yeah.
So he was pretending to do some kind of ballet.
Right.
And he claimed, while he was doing it, that he had done ballet when he was a child.
Right.
And it just looked so funny that we said, okay, we're shooting this.
Yeah.
So
that's why he just seemed so excited, I remember. When he
he was excited.
Yeah, that movie, and then it becomes sort of more, you're dealing with these guys that are kind of on the margins. It sort of became a place that you explored pretty well. But those two movies, certainly. Do you feel like, that was due to where you were at the time? Because your curiosity certainly sort of range.
I think it probably was. I mean, my first film was more of like tried to be a comedy.
Yeah.
Alice in Hollywood. It was also about somebody that was dispossessed, losing her way in Hollywood,
yeah.
living on the streets eventually. So I lived a block away from Hollywood Boulevard. So right. I saw a lot of kids on the street.
Yeah.
I wasn't one of the kids.
Yeah.
I didn't really, wasn't hanging out with them. I wasn't right. smoking pot with them or anything.
You weren't Larry Clark.
No, definitely. But although I admired that, you know, yeah. like I just was sort of visualizing, seeing their lives and like imagining what they were, or maybe reading John Reichy,
uh-huh.
reading about what was going on my own street. And what was going on was pretty heavy. You know, like if you really did yeah. get involved, it was very heavy.
Yeah, in my own Private Idaho and in Drugstore Cowboy, as heavy as it was, you know, somehow you tempered the tragedy
yeah.
that is Hollywood Boulevard at yeah. that time, I would imagine.
I think that both Malinoche was very funny
yeah.
as a book.
Yeah.
Drugstore Cowboy also was funny, even though you might read it and not really get the humor, but it was
yeah.
like it was a little bit like Larry Clark humor.
Yeah, I think it was funny.
And then My Own Private Idaho was more surrealistic.
But it funny. There's funny moments.
It was funny moments as well.
Because River was a narcoleptic, right?
Yeah.
And that was its own comedic
Which
thing.
Which came from George Eliot's Silas Marner.
Oh, really?
You know, it was just like this weird influence there and a little bit of Samuel Beckett.
Uh-huh.
And then a little bit of the reality and then Shakespeare.
Yeah. Well, they did Shakespeare, right?
They did.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, a combination
it's
of all
these
things.
It's a fun movie. It was a fun movie in that sense. You know, well, I mean, you mixed it up, right?
So, like, yeah, it was,
I
remember, totally, it was really like a collage
I mean,
of different
yeah.
things.
And then there was a shot where doesn't a house fall out of the sky?
Yeah.
Or am I making that up?
No, that
happened.
Does. Barn.
A barn, yeah.
But I think, yeah, Burroughs' cut up ideas were a little bit in play there.
So that's what you should have told Pasolini. I'm going to do what Burroughs did with literature to movies.
Yeah.
that's interesting. Was it in play? I mean, consciously, the cut up method?
I had done it, you know, I on my own, I had tried it too.
Yeah.
I had like written things
uh-huh.
by cutting them up and rewriting them like he was sort of explaining. So having already done that, also I had done a lot of, because of Robert Rauschenberg when I was a student,
yeah,
high school student, we did collages
uh-huh.
that were, you know, things cut out of magazines
sure.
and pasted together.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was used to cutting things up and putting them together. Marshall McLuhan was an influence.
Mm-hmm.
All these 60s things were an influence.
So they're all there. The beats through RISD, through the art, and then on
yeah.
to My Own Private
all
Idaho.
All into My Own Private Idaho. I was really putting everything I had into that one
and movie. It did well, and that was, didn't it? I mean,
yeah.
I remember it being
it
great.
New Line was very happy.
And, you know, you sort of changed Keanu's trajectory a bit, right?
Yeah, from Bill and Ted.
But again, there was a lot of funny in that. And then there was a lot of fun. To Die For is hilariously
yeah.
dark satire. And
yeah.
you work with Buck Henry.
Buck Henry.
And he's like that, going back again to Shapiro's world almost.
Yeah.
Before it.
Yeah. From the, he did that
The Graduate.
Sort of thing.
He did
yeah.
The Graduate.
And he was a prankster in the 50s. Like
yeah.
he would go on talk shows as a character. You know, an invented
uh-huh.
character that wanted to, like, put panties on horses, you know, because
right.
it was obscene.
Sure. Did that script exist without you? I mean, what was your
no,
relationship
that was
with
a,
Buck?
That was a, Buck and I had the same agent.
Yeah.
I can't remember where we met, unless it was through the agent. Probably was through the agent. And Buck was interested in working on something together.
Yeah.
So a producer had optioned the book called
right.
To Die For
yeah.
by Joyce Maynard. And Buck elected to be the screenwriter and I elected to be the director of the project.
I mean, you worked closely together then?
No, because, you know, Buck sort of like locks himself into his writing room and like writes.
Oh, yeah?
You know, he doesn't sort of spitball, at least with me.
But like once it was written, that was it? He didn't?
It was so good that I didn't, you know, have any
right.
suggestions for changes.
Did he like the movie?
I think he was happy with the movie. There were some things maybe that he doesn't like, but
yeah.
I mean, one of the things that he did when he wrote it, I can remember him saying that there was a lot of ways to cut this together because everything was like a bit, you know, a one
right.
minute
yeah.
almost like joke.
Yeah.
So you could do it many different ways in the editing room.
It's very interesting that like you know, where Joaquin Phoenix was at at that time, I guess River had passed away already.
Yeah, he had just died.
But like his acting, like, because in the new movie, Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far, like, you know, you can really see the arc within your films with that guy of like his craft just evolving to like this, like in, he was all in on To Die For, but it was almost feral. Like he was almost, you know, kind of like an animal. And but very raw. And in the new movie, it's such a meticulous and controlled, but, you know, very vulnerable performance. It's kind of an amazing thing he did. But like, how's your relationship? Like, have you been in touch with him over the years? Or?
Yeah, I had, after To Die For, I was pretty much in touch with him. We were neighbors in New York for a while.
Uh-huh.
We lived in New York City, and, we had projects that we sort of imagined together, that we never did. And even then we all, like Casey Affleck and Joaquin and myself, found ourselves, we were all neighbors in New York. We found ourselves here in LA, yeah, living near each other.
Oh, really?
So continue like just our ongoing kind of dreaming together. And so when this particular project, Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot, became available, it was something, yeah, that I had worked on in the 90s, became available again without Robin Williams. Robin Williams was one of the originators of the project.
Really?
Yeah. And
for the lead?
As the lead, yeah. And okay, he was developing it.
How long ago was that?
97.
Oh, so it's been, oh, a long time. Okay.
After Robin and I worked together in Good Will Hunting, he had offered me this particular story to develop for, mm-hmm, him. So I had developed a couple scripts with Robin.
Yeah.
And then it just sort of was one of those projects that he never got to.
Right.
And eventually when Robin had died, it surfaced again at Sony.
Oh, really?
They called me and they said, you know, what do we do with this?
They still had it. They were still curious about it because of the attention that Robin had given it, or
yeah, or else they just have a library that have certain things have bigger price tags than others,
and uh-huh,
they either want to like sell them or
get on
or
with it,
maybe do something with them.
Well, yeah, and with Robin on Good Will Hunting, I mean, you know, that was a huge turning point with him and for Matt Damon and for Ben. I mean, and you were brought in by, how did you get involved with that project?
Good Will Hunting was an executive at Miramax.
Uh-huh.
Mark Tusk was, yeah, his name. He and I were talking about Boston. We were talking about South Boston.
Sure. South.
And he mentioned this script. He said, oh, we just bought Ben and Matt's script. And I said, it's about South Boston. And he's like, well, it's about characters that live in South Boston. He said, I'll send it to you. So he sent it to me. And that's how I got a hold of it. And I originally had just called, I called Joaquin to find Casey's number and Casey's number to find Ben's number and got Ben and said, this is great. You guys, like, I knew that you had a script. I never thought to read it. Because it was sort of a legendary script written by two non-actors.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, non-writers.
Yeah.
It had been around for a few years. And I finally read it, and I was like, I didn't realize it was so amazing. It's like this amazing thing. And if you need a director, I'd be interested. Which was the beginning of sort of a long process of, you know, other directors considering it. Me sort of standing in line,
uh-huh,
before I could actually.
And you just, what was it specifically about that story that you made you want to do it?
I think it was not like the other stories that I had done. I think it was more of a uplifting story, uh-huh, which I was a little scared of. I didn't know whether I needed the down and dirty
yeah,
story to like survive as an artist or a dramatist.
What you mean, just at your fear for your personal integrity, or that what you could bring to it?
Or just whether I needed that kind of energy in order to actually make the dramatics work.
Uh-huh.
Because I had never done it. Everything, right, I had done up until then,
gritty,
was a little bit like about anti-heroes as opposed to heroes.
And then also like with even Cowgirls Get the Blues, you kind of like went big and weird.
Yeah.
So you kind of did that. It's interesting because, yeah, like it seems like from My Own Private Idaho to, you know, the surrealness, like you kind of even took it further. And I guess it got a little unhinged.
I got burned, going too high,
yeah,
too close to the sun.
But it was a risk for you, Good Will Hunting.
That's the way I felt, like, because mm-hmm, I was saying, I'll do it. And as I was saying those words, I was thinking, I wonder if I can.
Uh-huh.
You know, I wonder if I need, you know, something like I've done before.
Can you make a sweet movie?
Yeah, because it was very sweet.
But there's some darkness in it.
But I did like the kind of hidden genius aspect that the janitor is solving the problems on the Harvard chalkboard right, in the right. hallway was yeah, very, yeah. you know, was very, I guess, Dead Poet Society. It had this sort of warm and cuddly feeling about
sure,
it.
Sure, sure.
Which I really was a fan of that kind of film. I just never had done one. So I sort of, when I did do that movie, I kind of tried to put everything that I was doing in the other movies away
uh-huh.
to try and do something that was more like the movie wanted to be, you know, in the script.
Uh-huh. And you did it.
And it worked.
Yeah, it sure did. Now, okay, so obviously I can't go through every movie, though I want to, but I need to ask this pressing question. I mean, you know, to remake Psycho frame by frame,
mm-hmm.
That's an obsessive undertaking.
Yeah.
And what did you...
There's a whole reason behind it, if you want to hear the...
Yeah, I do. I want to hear the reason. I want to hear what you learned from it.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't... I think the process of doing it was the learning. It wasn't necessarily the result.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't really about learning about Hitchcock. It was more that during the 90s, the joke about the executives was that they would rather make a sequel than they would an original piece.
Yeah.
Because there was less risk, you know, so they would rather copy or continue a story that's already known in the public.
Right.
And they were really searching for some way to do that. Now they've found out that comics is the way to do it. Like, it already exists
right.
in the public's mind. But at the time, they were sort of searching. They hadn't found comic
and
books
And it's
yet.
A universe, too. The never-ending
It's never-ending. I mean, characters. That's they just hit what they wanted, you know? But back in the 90s, they hadn't found that yet.
Yeah.
So, but they were trying
yeah.
by doing, like, TV shows as movies. Like, they did the Flintstones as a movie.
Yeah.
They did the Brady Bunch as a movie.
Right.
So when I did Drugstore Cowboy, I was all of a sudden meeting with the, you know, heads of studios because they knew that actors would work with me. Therefore, if they got me on their movie, they could get the actor that they wanted. So it was less about me than it was about the actors. And so during one of the meetings, Casey Silver at Universal said he brought in all of his vice presidents. One guy was the head of the library. And he said, in the library, we have old films that you could remake. We have scripts that haven't been made yet that you could make. And it just reminded me of that thing that they wanted to do, which is remake something. And I said, what you guys haven't done is try to take a hit and remake it exactly, rather than like remake it and like put a new spin on it.
Yeah.
Just remake it for real.
Yeah.
Because I'd never seen that done yet as an experiment.
Right.
And the whole thing seemed experimental to me anyway.
Yeah.
So I thought, why not?
Yeah.
And they laughed. You know, they were like, they thought it was silly, ridiculous, absurd. And they laughed. And so they said, well, we won't be doing that. And that continued. Every time I would meet with Casey, I would bring it back up because I would remind myself, oh, you're the guy. And I locked in on Psycho. I'm not sure why Psycho, but it just seemed like the movie that would work the best.
Yeah.
I would bring it up again and they would laugh again. And then later when we did do Good Will Hunting and it did really well at the box office, before the Oscars, it also got nominated for like 9 Oscars or something. And the studios liked to
it
get
won
it.
A couple, didn't
it won a couple.
It
won a couple of Oscars.
Robin won?
Robin and Matt and Ben for writing.
Yeah, right.
But what they like to do, right, you know, the night before or the week before the Oscars happen, they like to get new deals in place with the people that are nominated because as soon as you win, they've got your movie going, you know. They can just lean over to their buddies and say, we've got that next movie.
Yeah, we got that guy.
And I think that's why they do it. And then they forget that they have it, you know, after the night's over. So they were trying to make a deal with me. And I had a deal at Paramount and I had a deal at some other studio. And then my agent was saying, Universal really wants to do a deal with you. What have you got anything for them? And I was like, Universal. Oh, yeah. Tell them Psycho, frame by frame, new cast, in color. And that's the idea. And then my agent calls back and said, they think that's fantastic. So all of a sudden they were in. After, so Money Talks.
After the, yeah, after the Academy Awards. Yeah.
After the box office.
Yeah.
It was really the box office.
Yeah, yeah.
The awards were also part of it.
Yeah.
So then we were, then I had to make the decision whether I really wanted to do it. After they said yes, I
right.
was like, oh, geez. And I was talking to Danny Elfman, who I wanted to do the score,
because uh-huh.
he was so good at doing Bernard Herrmann style
yeah.
scores. And he said, you know, they'll kill you if you make this. He knew. And I was like, who will kill me? He says, just everyone, like the critics, the everybody yeah. that loves Psycho will kill you. And I said, yeah, but the, Danny, this is an experiment. So this is not about who's going to get killed.
Yeah.
This is about doing, just doing it.
Yeah.
And then I thought, it doesn't matter if they kill me. And then later when I got killed, it hurt. But
because you put a lot of time into it.
Well, right? Because you actually care, you
yeah,
know, whether your movie succeeds. So it didn't work. But the, you know, the idea was whether or not you could actually remake something and it would repeat the box office.
Oh, that was the
you
idea.
Know, that was the sort of weird science experiment.
Sure. But did you glean anything from, you know, the process as a filmmaker? Nothing.
Not really. I mean, it's the same process each time, pretty much. You've got the model you're trying to make. Your,
sure, but did you, like, thing. I mean, that was one...
It was, you know, easier because we could copy the shots.
Yeah, a template.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, I mean, you know, Hitchcock was pretty good at editing, right?
Yeah.
So, like, when you're, you know, kind of repeating his moves, it didn't leave any lasting impression on you, or you at no point...
We were just copying the moves,
oh,
pretty much.
At no point you said, like, oh, this is kind of clever what he did.
I kind of already had looked at it that way. I could see what he had done. So right. it wasn't in repeating it, it didn't
yeah.
bring okay. any new insight. But we, you know, it obviously didn't work, but I think it lasted. It's more important now, I think, because people like yourself will ask questions about it. It's more alive now than it was
before,
back when it failed.
Sure. Yeah.
Just with, I guess, the art world or...
Yeah. Well,
the modern
they've
world.
Come around and realized, like, it was an experiment.
It was an experiment.
Yeah. I think that you know, I'm going to skip around, but like Elephant and Last Days, I thought were beautiful, poetic masterpieces, both of them. I loved them. I didn't see Jerry. I should.
Yeah, Jerry's the first one
yeah.
of the same sort of series of using very, you know, long amounts of time, more as if they really are, in that case, the desert, or as if you really are in a high school. Or
What provoked you to do that? What was the, like, the shift?
Jerry being the first one. Jerry started as a project that we were going to make a film without a screenplay.
Uh-huh.
And we were going to kind of like keep records and like improv and like make scenes up, but we weren't going to write them down.
Right.
So in the process of actually doing what we did in forging the dramatics and in the things that Matt and Casey did
yeah.
in the desert, I sort of was applying a style to it according to like what they were up to
uh-huh.
and the way to tell the story.
Uh-huh.
And it came kind of from a lot of different sources. The main one being Bélatar's Satan Tango.
Uh-huh.
Bélatar's a Hungarian filmmaker, because what we were kind of up to in the desert was sort of going that way. Cause I originally had thought we were going to make a film like a John Cassavetes film with a lot of talking, and they
yeah.
weren't really talking that much. So I thought there's still a way to keep going on this project.
Yeah.
And after I did that, I really wanted to try it again, and Elephant was the next wow. next time.
And what was it, why did you choose, you know, that Columbine? You know, why did you choose?
Jerry and Elephant and Last Days are all based on real incidents
yeah.
that are kind of have a mystery in the middle of them that can't really be solved because the people that can solve them are dead.
Right. Okay. So that was the...
So the first one was really the Kurt Cobain death, which ended up to be the last movie made.
Yeah.
The second one was Columbine, and the third one was Jerry. Columbine, I had been working on trying to find a home for it, and I had found one at HBO with Colin Callender. And he's the one that said, I can't do Columbine, but I can do Elephant. And I was like, what's Elephant? And he's like, it's a movie by Alan Clark. And I was realizing, oh, that's Harmony Korine's favorite movie. It's like this movie that I hadn't seen. And he referred to it as Elephant because it was in the middle of a crisis in England with Protestant Catholic violence. He made this piece that went on BBC in the middle of it and commented in its way on the violence, on the senselessness of the violence.
So Elephant was sort of a code name?
It was his name for it. And then we didn't have a title for it because he didn't want to call it Columbine. So we just ended up calling it Elephant, which we liked. We liked the title.
I can't imagine what that set was like, you know, to be improvising and using, you know, non-acting kids. I mean, it must have just, there must have been days on that set where it was menacing.
No, no, they were very good. I mean, the people that we cast were very good at making things up. Like we had pre-worked with them and found the kids that were just really good at, you know, just imagining something. And they were all quite young, you know, like 14, 15, and 16. So they were
into it,
adept enough that, like, to just pretend.
And those were the first movies you'd improvised like that? The Jerry and Elephant?
Yeah, exactly. And, well, I mean, the other movies, we had gone off the page even back in Drugstore Cowboy. You know, we would...
Sure.
Like Matt Dillon would go off the page and, you know, make things up or use other texts, you know, instead of the ones that we had.
Yeah.
There were other times that I had kind of gone off the page. This is the first time that we sort of made that the actual scene, you know, like not really having something written down.
And as a director, you're excited? Is it more exciting to do that because and an artist as to see as the thing reveals itself in real time?
Yes. It's very exciting.
Yeah.
Because a lot of magic happens at that moment when things are being made up. I think also all three stories were told as if the characters and what they talked about were really not the important thing. They weren't really the story.
Right.
They were just sort of noises that the characters made between each other.
Yeah.
They weren't going to tell you anything, or like the things that they said weren't going to inform you.
Right. What was your experience with, you know, what you had shot? Was there a clear difference between identifiably authentic moments and things that just kind of didn't work?
I think, well, all three of those movies are pretty much one take movies. They're one angle. So whatever's going on is not, it's not edited. It's just sort of one big long shot. I can't remember. I think that we arranged it so there wouldn't really ever be an incorrect thing unless somebody just said, stop, stop, stop. I can't go on, you know.
Did that happen?
But that didn't happen. They weren't unnerving. They weren't hard. They were fun.
Yeah.
The
Dark as they were. Last Days and you know, Elephant and Jerry.
The kids could do like whatever they wanted. We wouldn't tell them what not to do or what to do. They knew that we weren't going to like be disappointed. They felt free to do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And so long as sort of the actions
long as they get there.
Or getting where you're supposed to be getting, then which in the case of Elephant, they weren't really supposed to be getting anywhere. They're just wandering down the halls pretty much, or going to class or they're not trying to get anywhere. The shooters are trying to shoot people.
Right.
But Last Days, I mean, the character is trying to avoid people.
Yeah.
So he's doing that.
I thought that was really good. Yeah. He's an interesting actor, that guy. I mean, I haven't seen him in a lot. I mean, in Bully, I remember he was great in Bully. And then you go from those three to Milk, which is like a biopic.
Yeah. Straight ahead biopic.
Tight, man. You got it. Like, was that, what brought you to that project?
That was an Oliver Stone project originally that he decided after JFK that he was not going to do another assassination movie. And that he had developed it, actually, but with David Franzoni. There was like 12 screenplays. And there were a couple of producers who had bought the book The Mayor of Castro Street, which is where the original novel about Harvey's life.
Yeah.
And... that was my origin. I worked on a couple of screenplays on that one, and it never came about. And eventually, a different party, Lance Black, came up with a screenplay about the same guy and the same, you know, rising to politics in his life in San Francisco. So I said, well, I know this very well, so let's go make it.
You know? Yeah, so and you got an amazing cast.
Yeah, we called Sean.
How was it for you working with him?
I had, during another incarnation of the script, I'd actually contacted him before and asked him to do this biopic about Harvey Milk. And he was interested, and then we sort of, like, the project didn't happen, and I lost contact, and, like, years went by. Like, I think 10 years went by. And then, again, we were back into it. And Sean had gotten older. He was more the year age of the guy, of Harvey.
Yeah.
So called him back up. And I said, so what do you think about playing Harvey Milk? He lived in San Francisco at the time.
Sean did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm interested. I had never worked with him before. I'd worked with lots of different people. I think for him, we have a lot of things that we like that are similar. You know, like we have similar tastes in things, like styles. So I think that without too much discussion, we seemed to be in the same track of like what we were up to. I didn't really encumber him with a lot of details of things I needed, you know, like the way he held the pen in his hand, right, or anything like that, because he'll do it, like, and he likes to do it. And I found this with a lot of actors, you know, if you let them just do their thing, that's kind of their happy place.
Yeah.
Like, as opposed to being micromanaging, you know.
Yeah.
And so if they can do that, it gets them excited, because then they're contributing, they're right, inventing things for the camera. So in his case, he was happy. He said I was one of the only directors that he didn't feel like punching in the face at the end of the movie, which was a compliment.
Yeah.
I said, who was the other one? And he was like, Clint Eastwood.
That's nice.
Punched back.
And Brolin was great. And it was, did it,
Brolin, yeah.
Did you feel any sort of responsibility in that movie in terms of?
I mean, in every movie, you feel a huge responsibility.
But to the gay community?
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. I mean, you're very responsible to sort of like try and get things as right as you can. I mean, it's elusive, because I think the you know, looking back on that movie, the one thing that we may have like left out a little bit was the joy, you know, the gaiety of like the life on Castro. Like we were sort of so into the politics and the moment-to-moment things that I think we kind of didn't capture, like, the hilarity.
Now let's just arrive at this, you know, obviously there's more films to talk about, but I watched the new one, the one that you're out talking about, Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot, and I didn't know anything about that guy. And I didn't know that the book existed. I didn't know anything about the movie, and, you know, and as a sober guy, which I am, on top of a lot of other things, I thought it was the most effective movie about sobriety that I had seen in a long time, yeah, maybe ever, because I've never seen anybody address the amends process. And I think that that one,
number nine.
Yeah, sought to make an amends with people, you know, if you could in person, you know, face to face. And that one scene with Jack and Black and yeah, Joaquin is,
yeah,
and you built the weight of it properly. You know, that,
he was working his way towards that, yeah.
Right, and just like, how do you address the guy who you didn't even know,
yeah,
who was responsible for taking your legs and arms away, basically, you know? But like, I'm getting ahead of myself. I thought the movie was amazing, and he was amazing, and you know, what attracted you to this one?
Sort of like the Harvey Milk story. It was something that, although I knew John Callahan as a Portlander, and he was...
Oh, you did?
Yeah, he was a very visible person on the street in Portland because of his wheelchair and because of his bright red hair and the speed with which he was going down the street usually. And by the time I got to know him, it was because of his cartoons. Like, they were being printed in the weekly newspaper. And he had written a book. I was aware that there was a book. I hadn't looked at it or read it, but I kind of knew his story. I knew one of the cartoons sort of explained his drinking and his attempts at sobriety were in some of the cartoons. So you kind of got the picture in his cartoon.
And he was a bad, like, he was like a low bottom alcoholic, like a real, you know, hardcore alcoholic that just for people listening that, you know, that he wasn't a cartoonist when he lost his ability to walk and most of his ability to use his arms in a ridiculously dumb accident with another
guy. He was an artist.
Yeah.
Of sorts in high school.
Uh-huh.
And he was 21 when he had his accident.
Really, 21?
21, so he was quite young. And he was in Long Beach working. And the party that he went to was in Long Beach.
Yeah.
And the guy that he met, Dexter,
yeah,
was just a party guy in Long Beach.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Is that guy a real guy?
It's based on a real guy. I don't know his real name, but... our movie studio is very worried about, like, real names. I don't know. I don't think that he ever used any real names in his book.
John Callahan.
But we changed them. We changed a lot of them anyway.
I thought it was a fascinating decision on your part, which I assume it was on your part, of how you handled the actual accident. It's almost fleeting, you know, what you see of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see the car, you see them driving, but what actually changes the trajectory of this guy's life is like, what, 5 seconds, right?
Yeah, it's very short.
Yeah.
He was well known in Portland, yeah, and I had met him because of just being on, you know, around town, like, mm-hmm, just socially. And it was Robin Williams who had bought the book. He and his wife, who had a production company, had bought the John Callahan book,
uh-huh,
Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot. And they invited me to be the director and to develop a script with the writer.
Mm-hmm.
So I found some writer friends of mine and we made a script, sent it to Sony, and there just sort of wasn't any continuation. And then a few years later, we wrote a second script in 2002,
mm-hmm,
again, because they got interested in it again. Robin did, I guess.
Yeah.
And again, we wrote a script, sent it in, and there was just sort of like, you know, silence. You know,
yeah.
Time went by. So, which could have meant they just didn't like the script or weren't sure. Or
God forbid they tell you, right?
And then you don't usually hear, but it could be, you know, the studio, because the idea is you're taking Robin and you're putting him into this like very real story, and he's a quadriplegic, he's a cartoonist, he's like going through a 12-step program. And so I think by then there had been a number of recovery movies made that didn't make money.
Right.
So, okay. So who knows what combination of those things. So time just went by, and it was just one of those projects that I guess was never going to get made. And then John died in 2010, and then Robin died after that. Shortly after Robin had died, I think 2014, somebody called from Sony saying that they had this property
that you wrote
and that we had written scripts to. And I thought, do I want to like revisit it? So I started to work on a new script to see whether I kind of like could get what I wanted out of it.
Well,
the other two scripts were a little bit, they were written for Robin.
Right.
To do like Robin things, you know?
Right.
And we kind of strayed a little bit from the book, which was a little darker, a little more austere.
Yeah.
And so I worked on something that thought could work, which was closer to what I thought was his book. And I also called Joaquin because I thought, you know, I should really have somebody in mind if I actually get involved. So we did on spec, wrote a screenplay. Joaquin and I went into Sony and then they said no after all this. So, but they did allow us to take it somewhere else.
And then who did it?
Amazon.
Oh,
Amazon shot this.
I tell you, man, I can't imagine anyone else doing it but Joaquin in the form that it's in. You know, there's a certain, like, his commitment to that character, whatever he did. Like, because there's a weird thing that really bad alcoholics have in their demeanor, you know, which is like the bottom line is they need to drink, you know, now. Why am I not drinking? And, you know, he was able to sort of get that. It's a corruption of the soul in a way, you know, and you can see it in their disposition.
Mm.
And he was able to do that somehow.
Wow.
You know, like that scene where, you know, he's you know, after the accident, he still can't stop drinking, and he's in his wheelchair, and he's like knocking that half gallon of wine back in the park.
Yeah.
And those dudes come up to basically take, and he just gives them money to get their own. Like, you know,
yeah, get away.
Get away. Go get your own bottle. I need all of this.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, it was just a stunning performance. And I thought you just captured it all so well. And the story's like incredibly moving. How are you going to, you know, but it's really a recovery movie.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see it that way?
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing that we didn't go for in the earlier scripts, because even though he did go into AA, we didn't see him going through sort of the whole process.
Yeah.
The first script was sort of written in 12 chapters, mm-hmm. but they weren't specifically about steps.
Right.
And I thought that I wanted to actually address the act as much as we could, the steps, because we skip over a number of steps.
Right.
But it feels like you're kind of marching through the steps. And that was the kind of thing that I was trying to bring about in this new draft.
Yeah, I've never seen it before. But, you know, AA is weird about that, and historically about, being represented. Yeah. But I've grown as somebody who's in recovery to just like, look, it helps people, period. You know, I'm sorry if you're upset about the tradition, but, you know, we're not representing AA here. We're representing a guy's story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's intertwined. So, I mean, there were things about AA that I think were important for the characters to be paying attention to and to, like, be wrapped up by. And Donnie, you know, his character had to be sort of the authority. Jonah's character.
That was an interesting character, because I don't know how much of that was in the book or what, because it was unorthodox. I mean, the sort of, like, the guy who sponsors a lot of people is definitely not unorthodox, but the sort of meetings that weren't essentially AA meetings.
Mm-hmm. They were at his house.
Yeah.
These were things that John wrote about. He like...
Yeah, they had those meetings.
He may have like made that up. There were certain things that it seemed like John did play with the reality of things.
Well, they definitely have private meetings with people, and it would make sense. It's not that unusual, but it wasn't really an AA meeting. It was just sort of a group therapy trip, right? Mm-hmm. A little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely Joaquin, one of the main things that he does is he gets right into the middle of like his emotions concerning each scene.
Oh yeah?
Which is great for us, for the director and for the
rest. How do you mean?
Rest. Well, he's sort of in the middle, like when he's in the scene, he's just really in there. Yeah. So you can't really go wrong. He can't, and he makes it that way, fortunately. And he's trying to do that, I'm assuming.
That's just his process?
That's his process, to get to that point.
And what was different from the Joaquin that
he would never say that.
Right. What was different did you notice from working with him when he was a kid and working with him
the
now?
The same. It was really the same.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, he was way more experienced doing Don't Worry than To Die For. I mean,
sure.
To Die For, he hadn't acted in a while. He had been in things when he was younger, like 14.
Yeah.
He was in Parenthood,
right?
And he had been in Space Camp, which he remembers fondly. But he really immersed himself. I think it's just his natural way to do it, he just becomes the character. I think he it's not like maybe the method, but it's his own version of it,
Know,
where he's really like moving like the character, and when you say cut, he's not still in character, but somehow he gets close enough to it that he can pop in and out.
Wow. Yeah, it was great, and I hope it does well for you.
And I hope so too.
Yeah, and it was great talking to you.
Oh, thanks Mark.
Man. That was a lot of stuff I didn't know about him. Why would I? Yeah, I mean, that was the first time I talked to him. How could I have known? So, all right. So, do we play guitar? Do we? I'll do it. I'll do a little. I like it. I like the way this sounds. I plugged the thing into a new hole, and I haven't changed the strings yet, and it keeps getting filthier. We'll be right back.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.